Hi there, and good evening, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, and online. There we are at JimboTalk.net. You can follow me on Twitter, at JimboTalks. Well, the latest in the battle of how clean is clean enough started almost a year ago, last June, when the Environmental Protection Agency unveiled its Clean Power Plan. The Clean Power Plan would limit carbon dioxide emissions from existing fossil fuel-fired power plants, and according to a new report released today by the nonpartisan Energy Information Administration, the plan would modestly reduce the power sector's greenhouse gas emissions. Critics of the plan, including Republican lawmakers and some industry trade groups, say the power generation industry will suffer a significant loss of jobs, remember those, caused by the inevitable closing of fossil fuel-fired plants, for relatively little environmental gain. They also argue that the plan represents a vast overreach by the federal government. Remember that? Usurping the power of the states to regulate in their own best interests. The EPA counters this, calling it just the latest advance in using the existing Clean Air Act to establish public health goals while allowing the states the flexibility in how they choose to comply based on each state's needs. Obviously, we have considerable interpretation here, and let's discuss all of that tonight with Thomas Lindsay of the Texas Public Policy Foundation, online at texaspolicy.com. Good to have you with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Okay, give us your own analysis of what the Clean Power Plan is supposed to do and actually does.
Well, Jim, I think you said it well. The Clean Power Plan is a proposed regulation that is designed to reduce carbon emissions from the country's electric power plants, and all of this with a view to combating what is called climate change. It would fix a target for carbon dioxide emissions for each and every state, and would require in the process that each state craft a suite of laws over the course of the next year to meet this imposed target. Now, what does it really do? In reality, the EPA's Clean Power Plan is a sweeping assertion of federal power over the states for the purpose of radically overhauling the entire United States system of electric power. Here in Texas, the EPA's role would force Texas to change its own law to comply with a federal regulation that we believe, as do many others, violates federal law as well as the U.S. Constitution.
All right. There have been so many rationales put forward by this administration for this or that move that they've made, including the one that I love the most, and that is not even bothering to deign to give a rationale. But using the language of the Constitution, does anybody in this administration actually say, well, yeah, we've got the authority to do this under Article blank, Section blank? Anybody go that far?
Yes. The EPA claims authority for the Clean Power Plan under a provision that comes from the 1970 Clean Air Act. But, and here, this is becoming less and less of a partisan issue. Lawrence Tribe, Harvard Law professor, liberal icon, mentor of President Obama. In fact, Lawrence Tribe is such an environmentalist, he taught the first course on environmental law over three decades ago. He himself has testified that the Clean Power Plan, and here I'm quoting from it, he says, burning the Constitution should not become part of our national energy policy. And that's what he says the Clean Power Plan does, that it usurps the prerogatives of the states, of Congress, and of the federal courts all at once.
Boy, we have to emphasize what Thomas Lindsay just said, because he is everything. Lawrence Tribe, is everything that Mr. Lindsay called him. He is the uber liberal, the ultimate liberal. I mean, he would have been a Supreme Court justice, I suppose, had the era of the Reagans and the Bushes not been unlikely to pick him as a nominee. Extremely liberal, and as you note, that includes certainly in the environmental area. And for him to make a statement like that, burning the Constitution, I mean, that has got to be, I would think, even this administration might get a little embarrassed at that.
Well, one would think so, Jim. And you know, Tribe is to be credited here because, I mean, he has gone through the EPA's proposed rule. He's done an exhaustive survey of the Clean Air Act, and he said there is no way. I mean, look, the Obama administration has tried to get cap and trade passed. And if it had, it would have had some sort of authority in an actual law to do what they're trying to do. But they were not able to get cap and trade passed. So what this is an attempt to do is an end around by interpreting, and I would say misinterpreting, the 1970 Clean Air Act in order to accomplish what they can't accomplish through direct legislative means.
Another example of if you can't get it passed constitutionally, then this is just the latest equivalent of an executive order.
In its own way. Yes, in its own way it is. And it is certainly, and here again, I'm quoting from Lawrence Tribe. He said that it is, quote, constitutionally reckless.
Ah, wow. Well, so much for the rationale, the underpinning of this. Does any of this bring into question constitutionality of the Clean Air Act itself, or are we simply talking about an interpretation of that act that goes beyond the bounds?
Yeah, at this point, we're talking about the interpretation of that act. And to give the proper context for the listeners, I mean, let's think back here over the years of the Obama administration and even before, to organize and to establish federal oversight of the banking center, the Obama administration had to get Congress to pass Dodd-Frank. And to reorganize and regulate the nation's health care industry, the Obama administration needed Congress to enact Obamacare. But now, to reorganize and regulate the nation's energy providers, it tried to get Congress to legislate cap and trade, and when it failed, the Obama administration is now seeking to expand the regulatory reach of the EPA far beyond the powers that Congress delegated to it in the 1970 Clean Air Act. And that's really the crux of the issue.
You know, when I first saw the looming Obama candidacy, and I had misgivings about him because of my own personal views, but I was more concerned about his ideology. He was clearly the most liberal nominee who would ever have been put forward by the Democratic Party, which is saying something. I think he, in many regards, you could even consider him more liberal than, say, George McGovern. But I should have realized, having spent 3 years in Chicago, I should have realized that maybe my concerns should have been more greatly centered on the political atmosphere that first schooled Barack Obama in the Chicago political scene. It's snatch and grab and cheat and do anything that you have to do, that you feel you have to do, to win, and the rules be damned. And perhaps I should have been more concerned about that, or at the very least, the intersection of his ideology and his respect for the rules as he was trained. Because this is a bad intersection.
It is, Jim, and I have to say, as someone who was born and raised in Chicago and who still loves the White Sox, I fear nevertheless that you are correct, that there is some of that ethos that we've seen here in this rather blatant disregard for the rule of law.
We must always remember the definition of voter reform in Chicago, and that is that you insist that all the dead people be registered. We will come back and we'll talk some more. I wanted to talk about the legal underpinning, but then I want to come back and talk about the actual impact of this, get away from process, if you will, and down to actual impact on the environment, on the economy, on jobs, the J word, and it will continue to do that in the company of Thomas Lindsay of the Texas Public Policy Foundation, their website, TexasPublic.com. Clean Power Plan. Remember that. You may be hearing a lot more about it. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. And we're talking with Thomas Lindsay. He is the director of the Texas Public Policy Foundation Center for Higher Education, the director of their Center for 10th Amendment Action, which we might refer to as well before we're done. He was deputy chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities during the George W. Bush administration. And we're talking about the EPA's Clean Power Plan, which has been around now for just about a year. And we've talked about the legal underpinning for this. Now, down to the impact of it all, I gather that for those who don't find the constitutional questions troubling, there might at least be pause in terms of the payoff. In other words, is it really going to save the environment?
It is not. And this is adding insult to injury. The EPA itself, its estimates are that if this rule is adopted, it would reduce global warming by 0.02 degrees Celsius.
0.02 of a degree, not 0.2, 0.02 of a degree.
200. That's right. That's right. Now, let me put this in even greater context. The total amount of carbon dioxide emissions that the EPA hopes to gain across the United States by 2030, which is the target date, that entire amount that we would save, that much will be emitted by China in less than 2 weeks.
Yes, we will. We'll certainly return to this whole notion of what we do as opposed to what the rest of the world does, because that's a very important part of this entire equation. All right. So little impact at all. Do the proponents of this plan even differ with the numbers? Because if you're talking about a trade-off here, I mean, if this plan would, quote, save civilization, and again, we'll ignore the constitutional and legal objections that we addressed in the first segment tonight, but if it really would save humanity, then we might very well say, well, we'll just have to find jobs for these people who are dislocated because it's going to save humanity. This doesn't sound like it's going to save anything.
No, it's not. And the EPA itself hasn't said that it will. In fact, Gina McCarthy, who heads up the EPA, in Senate testimony, when she described this bill, she called it a, quote, great investment opportunity that had, quote, very little to do with pollution control.
Well, investment? I guess I must have missed part of this here. What, when you are stifling the economy and stifling business and stifling jobs, where's the investment opportunity here? I would think that this is a good time to get out of my energy stocks.
Yes. Well, the EPA thinks that this is a good investment opportunity in renewables, because that's what this, in the end, that's what this is.
Oh, this is a subsidy for Solyndra.
Yes. The first target, what we're talking about now, is going after coal-fired power plants. Yeah. Under this proposed rule, Texas, just as an example, Texas would have to close nearly half of its coal-fired plants. So what the EPA is trying to do is to force states to change their mix of energy sources away from coal and toward natural gas and renewables. But after they get rid of coal, then they'll come after natural gas. See, so right now, natural gas is not fighting as hard against this, because they're not the ones being affected.
Yes. First they came after the Jews, and I said nothing. Then they came after the Catholics, and I said nothing. So in this case, it's first they came after coal, and I said nothing. Then they came after natural gas, and I said nothing. And by that time, no one was left but me. Divide and conquer.
Exactly. And, you know, there are some who say that the EPA is playing an especially cynical game, and that is this, that they are betting that the natural gas industry will see that if coal-fired plants are being forced to shut down, that they, in the short term, will reap windfall profits in the short term until EPA comes after them. Now, some people accuse the EPA, therefore, of trying to play off coal against natural gas. And if that's true, Jim, and if it succeeds, then I can't help but be reminded of what Vladimir Lenin said. Mm-hmm. Vladimir Lenin, founder of the Soviet Union, said that The capitalists will fight with each other over who gets to sell us the rope with which we hang them.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. All right, now then. Part of this particular plan here, this clean power plan, requires states. Well, actually, let's put it this way. In the column that you wrote here, you say that states are asked, they are requested to submit state implementation plans to ensure full compliance with the new federal mandates. If this is all being mandated, why do even the proponents of this plan feel they must ask, they must request that of the states? That's an interesting choice of language for people who are so interested in running roughshod over the states.
Yes, well, the reason they have to ask is because EPA knows better than anyone they don't have the authority under the 1970 Clean Air Act to do this. So what they are hoping is that the states are going to do the job for them, which, of course, is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has ruled a couple of times in the last 20 years that the federal government cannot commandeer the states. And that's exactly what EPA is trying to do. It's trying to commandeer state agencies to implement a policy that they themselves lack the authority to implement.
Now, as I understand this, Oklahoma is not going to submit such a state implementation plan, and that there's a bill in the Texas House of Representatives to require Texas to also just say no. And then, in fact, you summarize there are 32 states in which some effort is being made in this direction. Now, what's the legal underpinning for that? Again, assuming that there's a constitutional basis for the CPP in the first place, to what extent, in fact, can the state simply say, gee, thanks a lot, but I think we'll pass?
Well, the rule itself, the Clean Power Plan rule, as proposed by the EPA, says that states shall submit what's called a SIP, a state implementation plan, meaning how they will arrive at these carbon reductions. And if they don't, they don't have to. But if they don't, then the EPA, through a federal implementation plan, will take over. So now the court has ruled very clearly here that this sort of mother may I approach is unconstitutional, because this is, in effect here, putting a gun to their heads and saying, you better come up with your own plan because ours is even worse.
You can't do it, right? Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and fortunately for the country and for our liberty, that's unconstitutional. And that is why you have so many people saying, look, this thing will never survive review by the federal courts.
We'll come back and we'll take a look at the extent to which that will happen and how soon that will happen, which might make this entire discussion moot, which would be a blessing based on what we have learned so far. So our number here is 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. The Environmental Protection Agency is, again, in the role of, hi, we're from the federal government and we're here to help you. And that is through their Clean Power Plan, which reduces carbon dioxide emissions barely, I mean almost infinitesimally, in exchange for considerable impact on the economy and on jobs. We'll come back and we'll talk about some of the impact on jobs out there. Granted, it's so brutally capitalistic to worry about such economic considerations, but we'll deign to do so when we come back with more in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show as we examine the Clean Power Plan from the Environmental Protection Agency, a plan which, as outlined by our guest tonight, Thomas Lindsay, director of the Texas Public Policy Foundation Center for Higher Education. And we've looked at the legal and constitutional questions about this. We've looked at its effectiveness, quote unquote. Now let's take a look at the price to pay for that 0.02 degrees Celsius decrease in that global warming. All right. In terms of Maybe Texas is a great place to start. Big state, big impact. What are we talking about here in terms of business losses, shareholders' losses, stakeholders' losses, that is to say, employees?
Well, looking first and foremost at consumers of electricity, they are going to be the ones most hurt. I mean, according to one study in Texas, and you can extrapolate these numbers for the rest of the country, Texas household electricity and gas bills would be raised 54%.
54%?
Yeah.
By what year?
By 2020, Jim.
Okay, which is 5 years from now. 54%.
And let me put that in real dollars. That means that the average household's annual power and gas bills are going to rise by over $1,000 a year as a result of the Clean Power Plan. Now, think about that for a second. As we know, energy prices and stagnant incomes have been straining the budgets of America's lower and middle class families for a number of years. Now, in Texas, households with annual incomes below $50,000 a year represent 49% of Texas's households. They spend an estimated average of 20% of their after-tax income on their energy bills. In fact, energy bills for the poorest households who earn less than $10,000, that represents 74% of their family income. So when you think about this now...
So it's regressive.
Exactly. That's right.
That's really odd. I mean, because, of course, the rhetoric from the left is always that we're out to help the little guy. This sounds like it would really drive a spike through the heart of the little guy. And this is something that I have found interesting, just to take this from a bigger perspective, and that is that this liberal coalition, they do not have common goals necessarily. For example, just to take immigration. There are any number of interest groups that support the Democratic Party that want the borders to virtually be thrown open. Why are unions in favor of that? In particular, why are union members in favor of that increase in the competition for jobs that are out there? And conversely, then we come down to this. And while I understand that the green weenies out there all think that this is wonderful, most of whom, of course, are doing quite nicely, thank you. But isn't there some... power in the hands of the poor, or some consideration to be paid for the poor? I mean, if you're a dyed-in-the-wool hemophiliac liberal, you bleed for all causes. Which one do you bleed for here?
Well, and that's the issue here, because when we think about these lower-income Americans who are going to be the hardest hit by the Clean Power Plan, who are we talking about? We're talking about minorities and the elderly who live on fixed incomes. They are going to be the ones who are going to shoulder the burden of a plan that has been shown to do no better than to lower temperatures 0.02 Celsius.
That's just amazing. All right. Is there anything in the plan which at least attempts to address this, such as, in addition, we're going to have, relocation grants for workers or retraining grants, or do they just airily dismiss this as the collateral damage of making the world green?
Oh, it's even worse than that. They predict that in time, energy prices will go down. There will be more jobs.
Wait. Where do they, on what basis? First of all, things over time may well change in terms of the competitiveness of these alternative energy sources. At the moment, perhaps, let's start from this perspective, Thomas Lindsay. At the moment, which of these alternative energy sources can survive on its own and compete with fossil fuels without the benefit of federal regulations or subsidies?
None. Absolutely none.
Not a one. Not solar, not wind, not geothermal,
right.
Nothing.
That's right. That's right.
So where do they come up with this line about how ultimate is this? Is this in the long run or shortly thereafter? At what point can they really, without a smile on their face or their fingers crossed behind their back, at what point can they really say that this will lower energy prices? I mean, I can't, surely not in the next 20 or 30 years.
Well, I'll tell you, Jim, the U.S. Senate is trying to take some measures with regard to this, and that is They have just introduced a bill, and we can talk about that later. But one of the, I think, the most important parts of the bill is to force the EPA to come clean with its methodology. How does it come up with these numbers? Because, as you know, there have been stories almost every day recently about bad reporting of numbers, about bad science being used to make these predictions. There is absolutely no reason why the American people should trust these predictions when everything that we do know tells us that the effects will be little, but that the cost to Americans in terms of their energy prices, in terms of their jobs, and in terms of their liberties will be great.
Well, let's dwell on that for a moment, take a break, and be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-5426. We've been talking about energy, in particular, the Clean Power Plan from the Environmental Protection Agency, just about a year old now, and we're doing so with Thomas Lindsay of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Now, interestingly enough, in the article that Mr. Lindsay wrote about this whole issue, he started out by quoting from Chief Justice John Roberts' 2012 opinion upholding Obamacare. Interesting. Please explain to us how that ruling affects something besides health care.
Yes, I'll do that, Jim. I say in the piece that, you know, many of us who are alarmed over growing federal encroachment by the federal government on the states and on the state citizens, all of us found many, many reasons to condemn Chief Justice John Roberts' opinion for the majority in NFIB versus Sebelius, the 2012 Supreme Court decision upholding Obamacare. But what many of the critics didn't notice was that in this very opinion, Justice Roberts offers states a practical roadmap for future resistance to unconstitutional federal overreach. And Roberts says this. He says, the states are separate and independent sovereigns. Sometimes they have to act like it, unquote.
Interesting.
And let me tell you something. That notion, I mean, that goes all the way back to our founding fathers. That goes all the way back to our Constitution, because as important as it is with the jobs that will be lost and the increase in electricity rates that will occur from the Clean Power Plan, what is most toxic about the Clean Power Plan is that it subverts our Constitution, it subverts the rule of law, and as we all know from history, it is the rule of law that separates civilization from barbarism.
Well, as most of us know from history, but be that as it may, let's talk a bit about something happening in the U.S. Senate called ARENA.
Yes, and ARENA is an acronym for a bill that was introduced by West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capital, along with six other senators, and it's called the Affordable, Reliable Energy Now Act, hence ARENA. And in her press advisory, Senator Capito states it very clearly. She says, quote, President Obama's misguided clean power plan threatens to drastically reduce coal-related jobs, increase energy prices, and reduce reliability. And so, therefore, what this proposed Senate bill would do, it would extend the deadline for states to comply with the Clean Power Plan, and states don't have to submit their own implementation plans before the law is reviewed by federal courts. And that's absolutely crucial, because you asked me earlier about efforts down here in Texas with House Bill 3590, which would just say no to the Clean Power Plan. There are a number of people here in Texas and across the country who they all agree with us that the Clean Power Plan is unconstitutional, economically destructive. But because they are certain that the Supreme Court will strike it down in time, and I believe they're right, but because they think that will happen, their attitude is, well, let's just take a wait-and-see attitude and not resist. But here's the problem with taking a wait-and-see attitude. ever since the EPA announced the Clean Power Plan last summer, just announced that it was going to propose it, ever since that time, and as we're speaking tonight, there are coal-fired plants in this country that are either shutting down or moving out of the country. So, in 5 or 6 years, when the Supreme Court strikes this thing down, it won't matter because EPA will have accomplished its goal. It will have decimated the coal industry and all of the tens of thousands of jobs that go with it.
Because obviously the coal industry is not stupid and they don't operate in a vacuum and they're aware of what's coming. And if they don't see any relief coming, then clearly their duty to their shareholders and their stakeholders, their employees, is to act now.
That's right.
In essence, I guess this ARENA bill in the Senate would basically give the states time to summon up the intestinal fortitude to do what Chief Justice Roberts suggested they have to do.
That's exactly right. It would give them the time. It would protect them from the dangers of a federal implementation plan. It would prevent the EPA from withholding federal highway funds from states that don't comply with the Clean Power Plan. It would even the governors of the states to not implement the plan if they decide that it would harm the state's economy.
Is there any timetable as to when the courts might look at this? Because I would note that it's not unheard of for courts to expedite rulings on things which, for example, can't wait. And this destruction of the coal industry to make this a moot point would seem to be a very valid basis for saying, Supreme Court, this can't wait.
Yes. Well, good point. And I talked to court watchers, and what they told me is this: that the EPA has structured the Clean Power Plan in such a way as to route any lawsuits by states first through the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals has of late not been friendly to the cause of individual liberty. So the EPA has thought this out. And therefore, I think it could be a number of years. And that's, again, why I say we can't wait. We have to resist now, because if we don't, by the time the court does rule, it will effectively be too late.
There's a method to their madness, so it would seem.
Yes.
All right. More to come. Stay with us. Tom Lindsay from the Texas Public Policy Foundation, 1-866-50-JIMBO, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hey, it's Jimmy Fallon. Here's what's happening later on The Tonight Show. Thank you, Hillary Clinton, for getting endorsed for president by several rappers, which explains your new nickname, Ghostface Hilla. Thank you, the Cannes Film Festival, for reportedly turning away women who weren't wearing heels. Man, they must really love telling people what they can and cannot do.
I can't.
You can't.
I can't.
No, welcome. Come on in.
Thank you, the NFL, for planning stricter security measures to the way balls are handled. Which explains your new name, TSA. There you go. That's the... Thank you, Activia, for not being called Go-Gurt. Catch the Tonight Show tonight on NBC.
To have you with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, as we are talking with Thomas Lindsay with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and we're talking about the Clean Power Plan from the Environmental Protection Agency. In terms of the ultimate court action here, is the administration actively pursuing the notion that, I mean, obviously they're not saying it, but do you think that this is their real rationale? Yeah, we'll lose in the courts eventually, but if we can just hold out long enough and delay this long enough, there will not be any coal industry left to save.
Well, Jim, I don't know the motive, but I can say that that will clearly be the effect. And as far as As far as deducing motives, you recall that back in 2008 during the presidential campaign, then Senator Obama said that he would close down coal plants. He said, we're going to make it impossible for you to do business.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I'll give this to the president. In some respects, he was not that much a stealth candidate. And I know many will blanch at my comparison, but I think it's valid. I'm not calling Barack Obama Hitler, but I would note that an awful lot of things that Hitler did were things he said he would do in his book Mein Kampf. But people, I guess, just said, well, he couldn't really mean that. And so I will make the comparison that goes this far in that. Things that candidate Obama and Senator Obama had said early on. I guess there must have been a lot of voters who said, well, he can't really mean that. Well, I guess he did.
Well, I think you're right that candidate Obama was pretty forthcoming about what the agenda would be. The problem was that many in the media weren't listening.
Or they just have different priorities. I mean, let's get right down to the nitty-gritty here. Politicians, I think, do care about jobs to the extent that you don't want voters irritated enough to vote against you if they lose theirs. But I'm not so sure that unelected people, and that may very well include some members of the media, really care that much. I've got mine. My job isn't going away. And if a bunch of blue collars lose their jobs, well, so be it. There are. I'm trying to make myself look morally superior here. And if a few thousand people lose their jobs, well, that's a small price to pay to make me feel better than you. Have I overstated the case?
Well, you know what makes it so sad is that when you use EPA's own estimates and you look at the statistics with regard to when the poor lack money, the things that they put off spending money on, and of course one of them is a couple of them are food and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Using the EPA's own numbers, if the Clean Power Plan goes through and with the increases that it will cause, more poor people are going to die because of this than will be saved, even by the EPA's own estimates.
Really?
Yes.
That, I mean, I know it's not a laughing matter, but at times this just really gets laughable. In other words, they've crunched these numbers. Are you serious?
And somebody in
summarizing this, presumably at some point this was summarized for the president. That's what presidents do. They get summaries of policy proposals. Do you suppose anybody had that at the bottom and therefore we conclude that X number of people would die one way and Y number the other way? I mean,
Jim, I think it'll play out this way, recognizing the terrible burden, the terrible additional burden that these increased electricity rates will put on the poor and on the elderly, the next program afterward will be a tax to subsidize them. So that's the way that they'll deal with it.
Another tax.
Another energy assistance program to pay for the damage done by the Clean Power Plan.
Are we going to reach the point where, in terms of energy, I know that we don't have a system of complete socialism in this country, but are we going to reach the point where there will be no more private power?
Well, not if we continue to follow the Constitution. And here I don't just mean the Constitution as originally written, but even as interpreted by the Supreme Court in the last 20 years. Even the Supreme Court in the last 20 years has said that what the Clean Power Plan is attempting to do is constitutionally beyond the pale. Now the question is, will we win this fight?
Fair enough. So people should keep in mind that things like the ARENA bill before the Senate needs to be backed. Check what your state legislature or governor is doing as regards not submitting a state implementation plan for the Clean Power Plan. Just a few things for you as homework. We thank you, Thomas Lindsay. Stay on the line. He's with TexasPolicy.com. This is Westwood One. there. Good evening. Welcome to the Jimbo Hannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO. 1-866-505-4626. Online, we're at jimbotalk.net. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jimbo Talks. We've all seen the pictures of the cultural artifacts in Iraq and Syria, the very cradle of civilization, mind you, which have been destroyed by ISIS forces when they take control of regions housing them. They say they are ordered by Allah to destroy evidence of worship of other gods. This, of course, besides being crap, is in effect an eradication of the region's cultural heritage, which stretches back at least 9 centuries before Christ. As we note, the earliest evidence of civilization occurred in that very area in the Fertile Crescent. Archaeologists, not surprisingly, are appalled at the ISIS track record of demolishing and desecrating priceless pre-Islamic antiquities, and they are aghast at what might happen now that ISIS has control of the Syrian town of Palmyra. And as a prologue, let us turn to a report by correspondent Barbara Starr in that regard to just take a look at where ISIS is at the moment.
ISIS solidified its control around the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra on Friday. In Iraq, it pushed east of Ramadi, taking the town of Husayba, a desperate situation as residents continue to flee Ramadi and other towns in Anbar province. And for the U.S., presidential rhetoric may be sorely outdated.
In Iraq and Syria, American leadership, including our military power, is stopping ISIL's advance.
President Obama says the U.S. isn't losing to ISIS, but senior U.S. military officials privately acknowledge the terror group's takeover of Ramadi is showing a key flaw the Pentagon had long worried about. Airstrikes alone can't defeat ISIS unless Iraqi forces step up and fight, and in Ramadi, that did not happen, and there could be political fallout.
They've had now a fairly serious defeat in Ramadi, for which the prime minister and the defense minister are taking the blame. This was not a particularly stable government before that. We should be concerned about our allies in Baghdad.
Critics say it's the Pentagon that needs to step up.
The flights, the combat sorties, are returning to the base without dropping a weapon. Do you know why? Because they don't have anybody on the ground to give them the targets that they need. This is an ineffectual air campaign.
I love you. Top U.S. commanders privately again rejected, recommending to the president U.S. troops on the ground to help find those ISIS targets to bomb. The only change? More arms for the Iraqi government and Sunni tribes. The White House worry now is Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi running out of time to deal ISIS a decisive blow.
And so with that report from Barbara Starr, let us talk with our guest in this portion of the program. And that is Deborah Lehr, co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition, online at their name, theantiquitiescoalition.org. Thank you, Ms. Lehr, for being with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for featuring this just historic tragedy.
Yeah, it's something that I suppose in some ways we should have seen coming. I mean, we certainly can recall the Taliban in Afghanistan opening up the artillery on those Buddhist sites over there. I mean, fundamentalist Islam is so malignant that this is just par for the course for what they do.
Well, you're right, and I think you captured it very nicely in your opening statement. I mean, obviously, the loss of life is just absolutely tragic. But what the Islamic State is clearly trying to do is not only, obviously, murder those who disagree with their fundamentalist beliefs, but actually eradicate the history that represents them. And so they're using this destruction of historic sites, of religious institutions and other things, as a means to intimidate local populations and as part of their shock and awe campaign to get on the front pages of newspapers.
Yeah. Just remarkable. We're going to take a look at just what all is taking place here. And again, for any who think that this is a misplaced priority, please keep in mind our coverage and, for that matter, every other media outlet's coverage of the loss of life, which has been extensive, and we've devoted hours to this subject. So I will not sit by and claim that that we are remiss in our priorities. We are providing 1 hour on this subject because it is important, because the heritage of mankind does matter. And therefore, we will devote this hour and unapologetically to the very subject at hand. Let's start with just a look at the types of things that are either in or could soon be in ISIS-controlled area. As I noted, and if anybody out there really paid attention back during that early world history stuff, I mean, the Fertile Crescent, basically the Mediterranean coast around Lebanon and Syria, swinging over to the Euphrates Valley. That was where civilization began.
Absolutely, and you're so right. This is not a decision or a choice between talking about people or stones. What we're really talking about are the representations of freedom of expression, freedoms of religion, of how culture expresses itself. And so it's very hard to separate out the loss of life, which obviously is exceedingly tragic, and what's happening with the destruction of these sites. And the worst part of it is they're not only going in and destroying them, but they're taking anything that they can, and they're using it to sell overseas to raise funds for their nefarious causes.
That is, and now that's so worth paying special attention to. If you weren't paying attention to what Deborah Lehr just said, not only are these people the lowest form of desecrators, but they're hypocrites to boot. Because if, in fact, the commandment from Allah is to destroy such evidence, then you wouldn't certainly deign to raise money by selling those very same artifacts. Very similar, in fact, to how the Taliban, on the one hand, eschews the use of narcotic drugs, while at the same time it is a huge opium grower in Afghanistan. Hypocrites on top of their religious fanaticism. That's just amazing that anybody could do this with a straight face.
That's right, and it's not just Christian targets that they're aiming for. It's other Islamic targets, too. It's Islamic beliefs that differ from their own. So Sufi Islam has been targeted a whole variety, and they are using this as one of their major sources of funding. And the challenge is for the demand countries, like the United States, one of the largest markets for antiquities, is we're seeing a huge increase and even just the legitimately declared trade coming in from Iraq and Syria of antiquities. And the trade is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And so if that's just the legitimate trade, the illicit trade is much higher. And so inadvertently, Americans who are not properly checking the background of these antiquities that are coming into the U.S. may actually be supporting the Islamic State cause.
Or maybe in some cases they just don't care, even if they have a pretty good idea. Now, that's worth looking at, I think, in comparison with something else, and that is activities that we have taken to try and prevent the trafficking in ivory, elephant tusks most notably, in some cases the hides of tigers or whatever this or that part of the world thinks has magical powers. The world has acted, I guess, fairly decisively to try and interrupt this trade. In many cases, I don't even know if you're allowed to buy and sell ivory anymore. Is that not correct?
Yes, the conservationists have done an excellent job in the wildlife trafficking people in making a link between the killing of elephants and the understanding of this object that you end up with that's been carved from ivory. And they have really raised awareness. And that is one of the things that my group, the Antiquities Coalition, is very focused on, is creating that awareness that when you're buying an ancient antiquity, that you're tracking where it came from. And there are a number of things that actually can be done. For example, there is a UN resolution that's been passed asking for countries like the United States and the European Union to actually close their borders to Syrian antiquities. This is the type of step we need to move on expeditiously.
Fair enough.
We need to close the U.S. border.
So be it, and a worthwhile effort indeed. We'll come back and we'll talk some more about this. Again, it's a part of the ISIS crisis that really hasn't gotten enough attention, and I thought it deserved, as I say, at least an hour. Goodness knows we will not be stopping our coverage of the brutality and the savagery and all the other negative impact of those who follow ISIS, but this is part of it. And it deserves our mention tonight. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number. 1-866-505-4626. Deborah Lair, co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition, is our guest. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad you're with us on the Jimbo Hanna Show tonight at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Our guest is Deborah Lair, the co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition, online at theantiquitiescoalition.org. I want to ask a little bit about the background, and I will pose a very Philistine view here, because there are probably people out there who feel this way. So feel free to take batting practice and knock it out of the park. Why should I care about a bunch of hunks of marble?
Excellent, and we do hear that question a lot. Mm-hmm. First, the trade in illicit antiquities, which I don't think a lot of people realize, is in the billions and billions of dollars, and it's one of the top five global crimes. So as a national security issue and foreign policy issue, it's significant. It's related to, often it's money laundering for drug cartels. It's obviously terrorist organizations and fundraising, and it's international criminal networks, as we see gangs in Eastern Europe and others who are trading in this. It's very easy because, unlike drugs, when you see them, or weapons, when you see them, you can tell they're automatically legal. If you see an ancient pot, for example, obviously it's very hard to tell if it's illicit or licit. And the prices of these are significant. But also, in places, as you rightly pointed out at the beginning of this segment, this area in the Middle East is representative of the beginnings of civilization. It's our shared common history, and it's who we are as people and the culture that we represent. I organized a conference last week hosted by the Egyptian government, and we brought together 10 ministers from the Middle East and North Africa region. And to hear the Iraqi Minister of Antiquities pleading with his colleagues saying, we need help, and the Libyan minister almost in tears saying, we're next in line. It really is incredibly moving about how to help them. And for them, this is obviously about their history, but it's also about their economic future. Many of these countries are dependent on cultural tourism. Egypt, for example, it was 11% of their GDP before the revolution. The Ministry of Antiquities alone is dependent on ticket sales and archaeological sites for its revenues, and when tourism dropped, it dropped 90% at the time when it's needed most in protecting these sites.
Fair enough. Well said. What do you do at the Antiquities Coalition? Obviously, this is center stage at the moment, but my guess would be not the only area of concern for you?
No, we've been looking at something we call cultural racketeering, and I know many of your listeners will realize that looting has been going on as long as people have been burying treasure. But what we look at, as you can tell from the name, is the organized aspect of it. And looking at the criminal networks that are operating in these areas and track what the size of this illicit market is and where are the choke points where we can start to crack down and bring in law enforcement to really cut off these networks.
Mm-hmm. Are you effective? I mean, you clearly must operate under the powers of persuasion. You must be able to convince governments who have enforcement powers, or you must convince individuals or non-government organizations to voluntarily go in this direction. In other words, you don't have a big stick here. You've got to have, a bully pulpit.
We don't have a big stick, and we're a relatively new organization. We actually were inspired after we saw the attempted looting of the Egyptian Museum and the Egyptian people surrounding it, trying to, create a fortification to stop it against looting. And we had actually done some work originally when we were founded in Egypt, and were inspired to find ways to help. And kind of the Antiquities Coalition came out of this because there are very few organizations in this field looking at the advocacy. And being a better archaeologist is actually going to improve the situation. It's really a marriage of the politics of foreign policy, national security, and archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe, given the background of various members, I was in the U.S. government for a number of years, for example, that we have some small part to play in this.
Well, one would certainly hope so. Have you had a receptive ear from the government in terms of the need to do something here?
We have had an amazing receptive and warm welcome from the governments in the region. We were amazingly inspired and actually quite surprised by the turnout that we had and the conference that we did last week. Really, the Egyptian government is willing to take a leadership role in this, and it was actually hosted jointly by their foreign ministry and the antiquities ministry, because they see this fight against antiquities looting and terrorist financing as part of their fight against extremism in the region. And there was absolute unanimous agreement that the Islamic State is not representative of Islam, and what they are doing cannot be covered by anything religious.
Is there any public outcry? I mean, there are times when ISIS must surely test the boundaries of even its own supporters or potential supporters, and I'm wondering if it matters, let's say, to the residents of Palmyra or Ramadi or wherever that these things are happening, granted, because they do have other considerations in their life, like staying alive until tomorrow, like getting enough food to stay alive until tomorrow, some pretty basic concerns. Is there, as far as you know, any groundswell of public sentiment in the area affected regarding these sites?
Obviously, the human tragedy is just horrific. But also there are people in all of these countries who are risking their lives trying to save these antiquities. And we know, for example, in Syria, we were unable to invite the Syrian Minister of Antiquities because of political reasons, but we had informal representatives there who talk about the cooperation actually beyond the political battle on the ground of trying to protect a number of these antiquities and these sites. They are risking their lives to try and bury them, hide them, store them, get them out of the country to a safe place. And we've seen that across the region.
Well, that's certainly encouraging to hear that in fact, there is some opposition to what's happening here. What has ISIS tended to do more, loot and sell, or just flat-out destroy like the Taliban did?
It's a combination of the two. For they have very actively encouraged looting of sites as a way to make money. And it's not just the actual Islamic State fighters that are doing it. They're encouraging local communities. And, you know, it's very hard to talk about not looting when people have a subsistence existence in these countries.
Mm-hmm.
But what they are not able to take with them, and particularly when they're going into areas of, say, a UNESCO World Heritage Site or somewhere that has a particular high value historically, then they are going in and destroying them because they know that that's part of their kind of shock and awe campaign. It gets them onto the front page of newspapers. Our hope in having this conference last week was really to get the region to come together to look at how as a region they can start to solve this problem, and then as a region, how they start to come and work with the demand countries where, you know, a large number of these antiquities are showing up.
Stay with us. More to come as we continue our discussion tonight about the desecration of and looting of the cultural treasures, not just of Iraq and Syria, which is serious enough, but also of the world in the cradle of civilization by the savages who are ISIS. More with Deborah Lair in just a moment. Welcome back. This is the Jimbo Haddon Show. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, and online you'll find us at jimbotalk.com. jimbotalk.net. We're talking tonight with Deborah Lair. She is co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition online at their name, theantiquitiescoalition.org. And currently chairs that group. She's the founding chair of the Capital Archaeological Institute at George Washington University in the nation's capital, and the vice chair of the Paulson Institute, a think tank founded by former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, located at the University of Chicago. She was previously senior advisor to the chairman of Merrill Lynch, was a senior managing director at the New York Stock Exchange, and also served in the federal government in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative at the National Security Council and in the Department of Commerce. Tell us some more, if you would, please, about what has happened in Egypt. Obviously not directly related to ISIS, but nonetheless a cultural tragedy.
It has been an absolute cultural tragedy. With the breakdown of the security apparatus after the revolution in January 2011, we started hearing reports of mass looting at every major archaeological site. And it wasn't just people going out with their shovels to dig in their back garden or under their houses. These were people moving in with bulldozers and heavy equipment. And essentially, they had shopping lists, and they knew what they were looking for. And based on our analysis, we have a conservative estimate that since January 2011, there has been about $3 billion in losses to illicit looting in Egypt alone.
Who is responsible for the Egyptian looting again?
It's a broad range. There are some extremist organizations that have been operating who are looting. When we look at the trafficking patterns of it, a large amount of it is going out through the Sinai. When Israel and Palestine were having their conflicts, for example, and they were cracking down on the tunnels coming into Israel, the Israeli government ironically seized a large number of Egyptian antiquities because they were seizing anything that was coming out of the tunnels, and it was all being smuggled out through the Sinai.
Wow. Other areas of the world, areas that we might not know about. Of course, we know about ISIS because of the other things they do. But are there places in the world where cultural desecration is taking place, maybe not connected to other atrocities, such that it's totally lost on the radar to most of us?
There's been a large amount of looting in Latin America, Peru in particular, with the historic treasures. China is another place that is very surprising, but it has had a huge amount of looting. It's estimated that 9 out of 10 tombs in China have actually been looted. And there's been a fair amount of activity by triads. And it's part, again, of these criminal organizations who set up distribution networks. And once they're established, they can run anything through them. So one day they may be trafficking humans, another it's drugs, another it's stolen antiquities. And once they can get these over the border into Hong Kong, it's much harder to view them as illegal because of some quirks in the Hong Kong law.
As regards the purchasers, how many of them are genuinely ignorant of the source, or how many of them are looking the other way? Obviously, you can't know for sure, but I'm sure you have a pretty good idea.
Obviously, it's very difficult to track these things down. I think for the higher-end purchases, particularly the ones that are coming out of the Middle East at this point, a lot of people are aware of where they're coming from and the fact that they're looted. But we're seeing an increase of items showing up on eBay, and I don't mean to point fingers at eBay. eBay has actually been very cooperative in trying to track these items and take down items when they believe that, or we can prove that they're illicit. The major auction houses have been selling them. There was a major raid 2 years ago on Christie's at one of their antiquities auctions in London. And the Egyptian government approached them with the belief that a large number of the items about to go on sale were actually illicit. And when they investigated, they actually ended up removing a lot of them and arresting the person who was selling them, because it's fairly easy to fake the provenance and give it, you know, a fake history.
Mm-hmm. Is there a big market out there? I mean, I must confess this is not one of the things I've ever pursued. I know there's a market in art and coins and stamps and the like. Honestly, I guess I just don't travel in the right circles. I've never known anybody who was a, quote, collector of antiquities.
It is a multi-billion dollar market. It is huge. people don't realize quite the extent of it. The FBI actually believes that, as I was saying earlier, the illegal trade in art antiquities is probably the third largest global crime after weapons and drugs.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Again, it was totally off my radar in that regard. I'm glad that you're coming on programs such as this. What other methods are you using to spread the word? Because I really don't think that most people have, even people who are reasonably well-informed, have a clue as to what's going on here, other than, as I noted, as an ancillary problem of ISIS.
That's right. And, you know, the one of the only positives to come out of the situation in ISIS is it truly raised awareness. And the fact that the video that they showed of the Mosul Museum when they were destroying that, that seemed to have raised awareness in a very similar way and touched a nerve like the bombing of the Bamiyan Buddhas. And what we're trying to do then is a result of that. And following on from this conference, we're going to do two types of awareness campaigns. One is in these countries to create awareness about how to protect and the value of heritage in country, but also starting to raise awareness in the demand countries like the United States and the UK and France, Japan, China, the Middle East itself, a number of the Gulf countries are large purchasers of these antiquities, is to help create in the minds of collectors the link between purchasing antiquities and these funding these organizations, or just having awareness and not purchasing priceless antiquities. We are not saying not to collect. We are not taking a position on that issue, which I know a number of archaeological organizations do. We are simply saying be aware of where it's coming from. Make sure it's legitimate.
Fair enough. More to come. Stay with us on the Jim Bohannon Show. Deborah Lehr, our guest. She is co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition. The website is their name, theantiquitiescoalition.org. And the culture of the world is being raped. We'll talk more in a moment. Thanks for being with us on the Jim Bohannon Show. We appreciate it. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're learning a bit about something of which I was fairly ignorant, and again, I like to think that I'm reasonably well-informed, but this had certainly gone under my radar, this whole notion of the destruction of and trading in cultural artifacts, yes, by ISIS in Iraq and Syria, but yes, by others in other places for various motives. And Deborah Lehr certainly knows her subject as co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition at theantiquitiescoalition.org. Now then, this Cairo Declaration that you recently worked on, what does that do?
Well, this is the conference that we held, the Cairo conference, was the first time that 10 antiquities ministries were in the room together from the region of the Middle East and Northern Africa to agree on a joint set of actions. And the Cairo Declaration proposes that, one, they see this as a serious issue. I know that may sound very small, but getting 10 governments, and you're in Washington, you understand this, 10 governments in a room together to admit that there's a problem and something needs to be done is a big step. But also that they would create a task force to look at doing several different things. One that's critically important is, as a region, negotiate something called Cultural Memorandum of Understanding with countries like the United States and the European Union. And why those are so important is because it gives us, the United States or the Europeans, the legal basis to shut our markets to direct customs to stop the import of antiquities from any of these countries. The other things that they're going to do include awareness campaigns, which I mentioned earlier, both in-country to help their own citizens understand the importance of protecting these sites, but raising awareness in the demand country markets, the collecting markets, so that they understand the linkages between the antiquities and these illicit digging or the funding of terrorist activities.
Mm-hmm.
Another is that we're gearing up to host during the UN General Assembly meetings a conference with UNESCO and the Asia Society and the Middle East Institute to bring together both then these countries coming out of the Cairo conference together with the demand countries to see then getting everyone in a room together to see how we can work on this issue, because as you so rightly pointed out, it really is in a crisis situation. It's not like we can grow another crop of antiquities next year.
Now, as regards punishment, there are any number of things that society says thou shouldn't do, but then we have various levels of seriousness about how sure we want to make that point get across. In terms of either people who are doing the looting in the countries of origin, or people who are doing the consuming in the other parts of the world, how serious are the penalties? Enough to deter those for whom the moral suasion is ineffective?
You have asked absolutely the right question. One, in the context of what ISIS is doing, actually cultural genocide, which is what they're doing through this destruction of sites, one is an early indicator of actual genocide, but also it's an act of war. It's a war crime. And so we have supported UNESCO in the call for ISIS and others to be tried in the International Criminal Court and for them to start an investigation. But two, then, there is definitely a need for capacity building in each of the countries, including in the U.S., to raise the penalties, because it's very, very difficult to actually try a case. And
why is it difficult to try a case? You're talking here about actual items in somebody's possession. It is not intuitively obvious to me why it is difficult to try a case unless you simply lack the will to do so.
Because it's so difficult. When you're looking at an antiquity, it's not looking at, say, a kilo of heroin. It's not recognizably illegal. So first you have to prove that it's illicit. Then you have to prove that the person knew it was illicit. Then it has to have a particular value to trigger criminal penalties. Then you have to collect all the evidence to take him, the individuals to court. Now, recently there was a major seizure of items, and there was a big repatriation where ICE, who have an absolutely spectacular crew in New York who are working, around the clock on these issues, and truly with the FBI ARCS crime squad, they have a complete caseload. What we're hoping to see because of this and because of the increase of imports coming in from Iraq and Syria and others, that we'll start to see more and more cases. But to date, it's been very hard. We work closely with a prosecuting attorney in New York, and he's had very few cases that he's actually been able to try successfully.
More to come. Stay with us. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, and we'll be back in a moment. Glad you're with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show tonight. We're talking with Deborah Lehr. She is co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition at theantiquitiescoalition.org online. To note one recent article about what ISIS has been up to, I will quote, "There is evidence that ISIS has been digging up archaeological sites and taking whatever they can." This is from the New Yorker. One archaeologist said some sites looked like Swiss cheese because of all the holes. To what extent, therefore, are we talking about irreparable damage?
It's absolutely irreparable damage. It's removing it from the context and losing any chance of studying what those civilizations represented, what their history were, what they were like. We have lost all kinds of history from what they've been doing. And it really is worth in taking a look at the satellite imagery that you can see in some of these cases. We have tracked the development of looting in Egypt, for example, and we picked just major archaeological sites, and we started looking at the time of the revolution in January 2011. By May 2011, a few months later, it was the same pattern. It was like Swiss cheese. The diggers come in, the looters, and they're just digging anywhere in massive pits and throwing whatever they find, looking for treasure as opposed to looking for history.
Remarkable. In a related question, I'm wondering the extent to which we take care of the antiquities that haven't been subject to such brutal treatment. In other words, how well do we respect historic homes and the like? I can cite an example of what I'm talking about in my hometown. of Lebanon, Missouri. At one point, the entire history of the state of Missouri, there had been one governor who had been twice elected because the governors at the time could not seek re-election, so it was an alternate term. And therefore, I thought of some importance. And that home was bulldozed for a car dealership, which I, given the locale, I mean, there were a lot of places you could have put that car dealership. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Do we treat our cultural artifacts well in general?
Another excellent question. You know, urban encroachment is really one of the biggest challenges to not just archaeological sites, but historic sites. And there's obviously a debate between those like you who can't appreciate the history of preserving one of these homes and the progress towards modernization. And finding that balance sometimes can be very challenging, and more important sometimes, finding the financial resources to not only maintain that site, but to preserve it in the way that it should be preserved. Mm-hmm. It's a huge challenge, and it's a huge challenge in the United States now, as many of these sort of home museums are facing huge financial challenges.
Which raises a very interesting point, too, and I'm glad you brought that up. It's one thing, of course, to say, well, we're not going to bulldoze it, but we're not going to maintain it either. We'll just sort of let the wear and tear and the passage of time and a total lack of maintenance and upkeep do their part until finally we can condemn that house, and then we'll put the car dealership in. Do we do a good job of what is the necessary maintenance of some of these things? I mean, let's face it, look at what it takes to maintain a home, and that's what these are. In many cases, homes or other types of structures, do we do a good job of maintaining them, even if we preserve them?
I think it's been very mixed. I think in cases where there is obviously something like a Monticello, it is recognized historic value in the United States, and people are willing to raise funds to support that. For some of the lesser known but historic homes or even museums, it's very hard these days to raise funds to support them, and there isn't a lot of money that comes from the government to support that type of activity.
In regards to what you would like to see done on the whole subject tonight of antiquities, anything that you would add that I haven't brought up that needs to be on the public agenda, either through government or a non-government activity or private volunteer activity, what else do we need to be doing?
Well, we always welcome volunteers to help in this cause. The most important thing in the United States is just raising awareness of the importance of making sure you know where these antiquities are coming from and that you are not inadvertently supporting the cause of these terrorists and these criminal networks.
Mm-hmm. Well, one could certainly hope that, in fact, we are vigilant about such efforts and that we keep moving in that direction. The Antiquities Coalition... Are you well-funded?
We're a very small NGO.
A non-government organization,
for those who
don't know the term.
Yes. And we're always hoping for additional support.
Are you a 501c3 or otherwise offer any tax incentive for those who don't find the moral imperative sufficient?
Yes, we are. We are a 501c3 not-for-profit.
All right, very good. So, in short, if you are out there and you're thinking about getting your fiscal ducks in a row before the next tax year comes to a close, you might keep in mind theantiquitiescoalition.org, theantiquitiescoalition.org. Cultural heritage is a terrible thing to waste, and my guess would be that huge portions of it have already been lost over the years anyway. I mean, if you were to take the sum total of human culture, my guess is that 99% of it's been destroyed.
That's probably right, but the interesting thing is there's so much more to be found still. And if you take Egypt just as an example, there's a belief by many of the archaeologists that maybe conservatively 25% has been excavated, which means there's 75% still to be found. And our hope is that it will be found by legitimate archaeologists and not by the thief.
All right, very good. Stay on the line, please, and we'll speak off-air briefly. Deborah Lair, she is co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition. Their website is their name, theantiquitiescoalition.org. And we're looking at the rape of our cultural artifacts, not just by ISIS in Syria and Iraq, but elsewhere around the world. So something to think about. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One. Hello there, and good evening, good morning. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We are at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, find us at jimbotalk.net, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Jimbo Talks. Thanks to our guests in the program tonight, a couple of worthwhile stories that have not gotten their due, I believe. Specifically, in the first hour, Thomas Lindsay of the Texas Public Policy Foundation on the Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan, which no less a devoted liberal, particularly on environmental matters, than Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe has noted, was burning the Constitution. We'll see how far that goes. There are efforts underway to stop it in its tracks. And in the past hour, Deborah Lehr, a very accomplished individual in a variety of fields, from trade with China all the way to her current efforts as co-founder of the Antiquities Coalition, online at their name, theantiquitiescoalition.org, and a look at the desecration of historic sites within ISIS-controlled territory, a problem that has extended, of course, to Egypt, to Afghanistan, and Latin America, other places around the world. It's not just ISIS, but others for whom the world's cultural heritage is fair game, as it were. Coming up on the Bohannon Show this coming Monday evening, here we go, we're going to talk with Eric Blim, who has related the tales of our special forces in Iraq and Afghanistan in a series of best-selling books. And Mr. Blim has now set his sights on heroism during the Vietnam War. He will join us to talk about his new book on the subject called Legend, Eric Blim, on the next Bohannon Show. That will be in our second hour, Monday night, Memorial Day night. And in the midnight hour, this is amazing, but it's been 50 years. If you, in fact, are old enough and follow boxing, Monday will be the half-century anniversary of Ali Liston II, the non-thriller in Lewiston, as some might refer to it. I can tell you that I was, in fact, alive. I was with my father, who was a traveling salesman in Missouri. We were in Jefferson City, Missouri, the capital. So that probably tells me it was probably a Tuesday night, because that's when he always spent, that's where he was every Tuesday night. And we were listening on the radio. At the time, it never occurred to me, but it was the Mutual Broadcasting coverage of that fight. And my father, as it was just beginning, went to the bathroom. He came out of the bathroom, and I said, "It's over." And it was a first-round knockout by what some call a phantom punch from Muhammad Ali. Did Sonny Liston take a dive? Was he paid off? It's always been a subject of great controversy in the world of boxing lore. And the last time I talked, we were scheduled also to have a guest on at that time regarding boxing. We have not had, I guess, further confirmation of that. I'm sorry, say again, please. Not yet confirmed, but we expect to. We'll probably talk a little bit about boxing in the context of it. But what we're going to do Monday night in our third hour is give you the complete Mutual Broadcasting coverage of the fight, which, as it turns out, was 6 minutes and 37 seconds. It was short, but memorable. It was a Tuesday. I thought it had to be a Tuesday. Yeah, my father spent Tuesday nights in Jefferson City, Missouri, for decades, so I figured it probably had to be. But we'll play that for you. An interesting bit of broadcast history, the Ali Liston II battle from Lewiston, Maine, and the famous Phantom Punch. We'll talk about that on Monday night here on the Bohannon Show. I note in Atlanta. Officials are suspending an advertising campaign telling people not to run from police. They had put up billboards with things like "Don't Run" and ads that show a running man with a red circle and a red line through it. Some of the signs had urged "Stay calm, don't run, report police misconduct." But now those are coming down because, as one Atlanta City Councilwoman put it, the campaign sends the message that people are doing something wrong by running. Well, yes, it does, dummo, because they are. In other words, the message from the city councilwoman, here's the message that she's sending. If you want to run from the cops, run from the cops, because law enforcement is the least of our concern on the Atlanta City Council. My Lord, the brain-dead level of some public officials. Anyway, for what it's worth, just toss that out there for you. We can go to JimboTalk.net, where we find our esteemed poll. It's an unscientific poll, but we have fun. And without parsing out the demographics or anything like that, we'll just ask you how you feel about stuff, and you tell us. Every week we have a new question. Last week was about hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And we had asked the same question once about nuclear power plants. The question was, how close would you be willing to live to one? In this case, a fracking operation. 28% of you said, keep it 200 miles away at least, please. That was the bare plurality. 6% said 100 to 200 miles. 22% said between 20 and 100. 17% said under 20 miles. But 27% of you, almost the plurality, said close as you want, in my backyard. We don't have to make that a frack-free zone as far as they're concerned. All right, this week's question has to do with Joakar Tsarnaev. How long will it take for him to be executed? He's been found guilty of the Boston Marathon bombings and sentenced to death, but how long will that take? Choices: under a year, 1 to 3 years, 3 to 5 years, more than 5 years, or he will never be executed. Just go to JimboTalk.net and click on our poll. Stay with us. More to come on the Bohannon Show, as we will take note of the weekend that we have entered in just a moment.
Jim Roberts, president of the American Veterans Center, and I invite you to attend the 2015 National Memorial Day Parade, Monday, May 25th at 2 o'clock p.m. along Constitution Avenue. Join thousands as we honor the service and sacrifices of our military from the American Revolution to today, featuring veterans units, marching bands, celebrities, and active duty troops. The parade is produced by the American Veterans Center and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, Leidos, and USBA. To learn more about how you can see the parade, visit National Memorial Day Parade.
Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. As, that's a very important thing, the National Memorial Day Parade. Good lineup of folks taking part. Of course, actor Gary Sinise, probably Hollywood's most reliable supporter of those in uniform. Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins will be there. Also, Joe Mantegna, the actor, celebrity chef and Royal Navy veteran Robert Irvine, Miss America 2015 Kira Kazantsev, Chris Melendez, professional wrestler, and by the way, also Purple Heart recipient, will be on hand. And of course, hundreds of veterans, led by the Grand Marshal's Veterans of World War II Equestrian Unit, Color Guards, Military Vehicles, the U.S. Army Band, plus marching platoons from the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, all taking part. Hosting the parade telecast, by the way, will be Rita Cosby and Paul Berry, Kirsten Hagland, Miss America 08, a special correspondent, parade to be televised on Reels. Channel nationally, R-E-E-L-Z, at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday. And in the nation's capital area, that'll be on News Channel 8. And also it'll be on the American Forces Network in 175 countries worldwide, streamed on military.com. And anyone can march with the troops via virtualbootsontheground.com. virtualbootsontheground.com. And using the hashtag NMD Parade on social media, as in National Memorial Day, NMD Parade on social media. That's pretty special. And again, I hope that you do something to take part in this particular gathering. It's the 10th annual National Memorial Day Parade. I have spoken in the past about our lack of observance of such parades and the importance of them. I did so post 9/11 and Veterans Day of 01, urged for a nationwide call to get out and support such parades. And if you don't have one, to organize such a parade, which is very important as well. So I can only say that I don't know if we've had much of a resurgence. I would like to think that we might have. I know we're all very busy and we have so many things to do these days, especially so many virtual things, but it doesn't hurt to do something that is real, actually going to such a parade. It doesn't require a lot, you know, to organize a parade in the smallest community. Even towns that, for example, don't even have so much as a high school marching band. I know that in some little towns across the country, if there's a local radio station that can be of assistance, I do know that on some occasions, today, of course, you wouldn't do it with transistor radios. You'd do it with your smartphone. But the local radio station would play marching music, and everybody in the parade would hold up their transistor radio, and they would march to the music being played by the local radio station. It's not that difficult to recognize those who have given so much in the defense of their country. Hope you'll keep that in mind, as I say. It's important. Memorial Day at the Vietnam Veterans Wall will start at 1 p.m., the parade starts at 2. The ceremony will have, of course, thousands of veterans and family members from all across the country. Speakers will include representatives of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund and National Park Service and the Vietnam Women's Memorial Foundation. Introduction will be given by Jan Scruggs, the founder and president of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. The ceremony will include the traditional presentation of colors, singing of the national anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance, Diane Carlson Evans, founder and president of the Vietnam Women's Memorial Foundation, will speak on their behalf. A special focus for this year's ceremony will be the Vietnam Medal of Honor recipients. As part of the ceremony, the U.S. Postal Service will dedicate the 2015 Medal of Honor Vietnam Forever stamps. Medal of Honor, of course, the highest award for valor that can be given. There were 258 of them issued for actions related to the Vietnam War. 159 of those are on the wall, which is to say, deceased. At this time, there are 54 living Vietnam Medal of Honor recipients. This may be Jan Scruggs' last time doing something like this. I don't know. I believe he is retiring as head of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. He, of course, the man who single-handedly, on sheer grit and determination, forced the government to accept this ultimate tribute to the Vietnam veterans, who didn't get much of one the first time around. So we've tried to get in touch with Jan, haven't heard back from him. There are other activities taking place around the country. Detroit Public Television is partnering with Michigan State University on something called Veterans Books, which is a special program that they have putting on there. You can go to their website, Detroit Public Television. I don't happen to have that right in front of me, but I know you can find it fairly easy through the Google method. Something that we told you about last night on the program, the movie American Sniper is now being made available from Warner Brothers on Blu-ray, in the Blu-ray combo pack on DVD and digital HD. And what's interesting is that Warner Brothers is donating a dollar of each sale, physical or digital sales, to the Wounded Warrior Project, up to a total of $1 million through the end of this year. So that's worthwhile as well. It's good to see good people doing good things. There is also a group called MoveAmericaForward.org, which is organizing care packages for our heroes, raising money to try and see to it that everybody who is in uniform out there can receive something to show that we appreciate their sacrifices for their country. They're trying to raise $300,000 and are asking for donations, which are tax deductible, again, at moveamericaforward.org. That's important stuff, and I hope that you will do your part. The original somber meaning of Memorial Day has really been lost over the years. It was established as a remembrance of American military members who died in service to the country. Many, of course, regard it as just the unofficial opening of summer, and it's a weekend for barbecues, swimming, and other summertime activities. Fine and well. But please take out a little bit of time, especially if you have children, a little bit of time to explain to them why they get the day off. President Johnson, in 1966, declared Waterloo, New York, to be the birthplace of Memorial Day. But probably there were celebrations and memorials nationwide just after the Civil War in many locations. There is evidence that Southern women organized to decorate the graves of the fallen before the war ended. That was called Decoration Day. One of the earliest recorded celebrations occurred in Charleston, South Carolina, where freed slaves, teachers, and missionaries gathered on May 1st of 1865, just days after the end of the Civil War, to honor Union soldiers who had been captured or held at the Charleston Racecourse, a notorious prison camp there. And the prisoners there, by the way, died in captivity and were buried in unmarked graves. The celebration in Waterloo, New York, began in the summer of that same year and was fully recognized, organized, I should say, by 1866, with some help from residents and veterans, into a formal celebration. It was 1868 that Memorial Day was officially established by General John Logan, commander of the Grand Army of the Republic, the name that pretty much encompassed all of the Union soldiers at the time, and was celebrated on May 30th of 1868. Flowers were placed on the graves of both Union and Confederate soldiers at Arlington National Cemetery. The first state to adopt the holiday was New York in 1873. By the 1890s, it was recognized in all the northern states, though the South refused to acknowledge the day. Southern states maintained their own Confederate Memorial Day until after World War I, when the holiday was changed to honor the dead of all U.S. wars instead of just the Civil War. And, of course, you may recall, if you're old enough, I haven't seen one of these in quite a while, the poppy. Buy a poppy from a veteran. It became associated with the holiday in 1915 when Moina Michael, inspired by the John McCrae poem In Flanders Field, wrote her own poem called We Shall Keep the Faith and came up with the idea of wearing red poppies in commemoration of the day. The tradition, by the way, spread to other countries. Michael was honored in 1948 by the U.S. Post Office with a stamp with her likeness on it. It was in 2000 that the White House issued a resolution signed by President Bill Clinton, urging all Americans to pause at 3 p.m. Memorial Day for a moment of reflection and respect to those who have died. So that's some of the story behind Memorial Day. Enjoy. Have a wonderful time. Have a safe, wonderful time, as we noted last night on the program. Have a safe time that involves not running red lights and watching out for cyber thieves. Enjoy the hot dogs, enjoy the barbecue, enjoy the swimming, enjoy the badminton or whatever it is you do. But just please take a moment, if you would. Just a moment. Doesn't seem like that should be too much, really. I don't think. Just a moment to remember why it is that we are having this day off. Memorial Day matters. It matters because of the people who, in fact, have made it possible. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626 on the Bohannon Show. I'd love your thoughts about Memorial Day in one way or another when we come back on the Bohannon Show in just a moment. Thanks for joining us on the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-54626. Welcome to the Memorial Day weekend. And, yeah, it's sort of the unofficial beginning of summer. We're actually about a month away from the official beginning of summer, but this can count. As we talk to Gus, who calls in from Syracuse. Hello, Gus.
Hello. Prior to 1971, Memorial Day was always celebrated on May 30th, and I'm 63 years old, and to me, the holiday has lost some of its meaning because it's been put on a Monday, and I always wondered to myself, what if July 4th was moved to the first Monday of July and put it to a vote of the American people, or Veterans Day? How about moving Veterans Day to a Monday? I mean...
Well, Veterans Day is often observed. I mean, Veterans Day technically, of course, is November the 11th, but if I'm not mistaken, Veterans Day is observed as a Monday holiday.
I thought it was November 11th.
I'd have to double check on that, but I could be wrong. If you put it to a vote, you might be disappointed, I think, Gus, because I think most people would say, hey, another 4-day weekend, you bet, or 3-day weekend, I think it would probably pass. Even something as bizarre sounding as the 4th of July, obviously you'd have to start calling it Independence Day. It'd be kind of stupid to celebrate the 4th of July on July the 7th, say, but, people like their 3-day weekends.
About that.
Pardon?
We've been brainwashed to have these holidays on Monday. Like you take Lincoln and Washington's birthday used to be Lincoln's birthday was on the 12th,
right?
And Washington was the 22nd. Now they've combined them to a Monday.
They have, and it's called President's Day in honor of a day on which no president was born. But again, I don't know that we've been brainwashed as much as the historical purists, and that would include people like you and me, have bowed to public pressure. I mean, the public wants it. I don't say that makes them right, but I don't think that it's a case of the public being dragged to this. I think that this is just the people want the time off. And I'll grant you that very few Americans think a thing about Lincoln, about Washington, or any other president on President's Day. And regrettably, few will be thinking about our veterans on Veterans Day or Memorial Day. It's sad.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, I share your thoughts in that regard, but the whole 4-day weekend thing, I got to tell you very honestly, I think we like them a lot. I probably don't care that much about them because in broadcasting, of course, we're a 24/7 operation, and if I were to take off Memorial Day, that's vacation time for me because you expect your radio to be on, or you expect your TV to be on. So it's never been a big deal. We have a call from Akron, Ohio, and I guess you just need to jack up that volume there, Paul. Wanda in Akron, Ohio. Hello. Welcome, Wanda.
Hi. I remember in the 40s, we had also called Decoration Day. We dressed up in a little white dress. I was grade school. And writing, we carried little flowers called flags, only they were iris.
Uh-huh.
And they were called flags. And then we also would carry a little flag and march over to the cemetery where they had the ceremony for the Memorial Day. Anyhow, that was just a little memory of...
Well, it's a great memory, and it's a memory, unfortunately, that is alien to far too many young people in this country today. They've never done anything like that, and that's wrong.
No, right. It was very exciting as a young girl to do that.
But let's be very honest about it, Wanda. It was exciting in part because you didn't have a zillion other distractions. You did not have a smartphone on which you had to text your friends. You did not have all the websites to go to. You did not have a Facebook page to update. You did not have countless emails to send to people. You did not have 500 cable channels to watch. You did not have all of the distractions that we have today. It was exciting in part because what else was there to do?
I guess that's right.
Yeah, and then that's part of the problem. And I'm not saying that we should therefore abandon the digital age, which obviously wouldn't happen even if I said it, but we shouldn't. But I'm simply noting, as you have so eloquently, that we should not let modern conveniences get in the way of historic imperatives. And that is to say, take a little time. Remember this stuff. It matters.
It does. And we still have a parade in town. The Memorial Day Parade, and it stops at the old church, and the bell tolls, and then the band and the parade. People walk on down to the cemetery. I usually always went, but I'm 80, and the last 2 years I haven't walked out and done that. But it's a good thing.
Well, it is a very good thing. It's a very good thing, and I commend you for your patriotism and for your profoundly important memory. Thank you very, very much, Wanda.
Well, thank you to all our servicemen who serve.
Absolutely. I certainly echo that. Let's go to David in Creston, Iowa on the Jim Bohannon Show. Hello, David.
Hello. How are you, Jim?
Thank you very much
for taking my call.
Thank you.
I wanted to get a message out to people, and I guess you're the best source that I can do this with. And I wouldn't want these people to thank God that these people, these brave men and women, gave their lives for us to enjoy the freedoms that we have today.
Yes.
No one ever went to war that wanted not to come home.
You know, if you go to war, you have to go with the understanding that that, in fact, can happen, that you can die, and it's not a pleasant thing to contemplate. I can remember during the Tet Offensive on January 31st of 1968 in Long Bend, Vietnam, and there were moments when I wondered just exactly how that was going to turn out. The Viet Cong in our particular sector had gotten to within about, I guess, 100 yards of our perimeter, and they kept coming, and it wasn't that clear what was going to necessarily happen. So, yeah, you really need to always remember that this is not like other forms of service. This is not like other forms of service at all. People die, and people who come back could have died. And that's what I hope people will remember. I mean, I really do.
I do, too. I really appreciate you saying that. You don't realize this until you actually see somebody on the field, and you know that they're bleeding to death, and they're not going to go home.
That's an ugly. The only media presentation I've ever seen that even approximated combat was the opening scenes of Saving Private Ryan.
And the other thing that I wish that the president of this United States would do on Memorial Day is to make a public appearance, whether he agrees with any of this or not, to let people know that we should take a moment out for all these people that died for our freedoms. And, We shouldn't take it for granted, not for a minute.
No, we should not. Amen.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you very much. As we take a call now from Shannon in Fairhaven, Massachusetts, on the beginnings of your Labor Day weekend. And I guess, wait a minute, did I hit the wrong line? Or is this Shannon in Fairhaven, Mass?
Yeah, you got me, Jim.
I got you, Shannon. Thank you very much.
Jim. I listen to you every night.
Thank you.
Every night I'm listening to you when I'm in my bed.
I appreciate that. Thank you, man.
Yeah, I appreciate you and listen to me. I love all the vets, and I give all my best to them, and I do donate to them. Are you there?
Yes, ma'am. I'm right here.
I donate to them, and I love every minute of everything they ever did for me, and I appreciate them, and I appreciate you. And listen, I love you, but that guy never lets me through to you, Harvey.
Well, I'm sure he does. I'm sure he does. Absolutely.
I love you. And listen, my mom's got Alzheimer's. And remember you told me to listen to the music with what's his name, Engelbert Humperdinck.
Well, we have had Engelbert on, I would grant you, and we have musical guests on from time to time. Well, thank you for your listenership. We do appreciate it very much, Shannon. Thank you so much. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-5426. It's a Friday night, and that, of course, means that our man, Mighty John Marshall of MoneyMusic.com, is standing by.
Hi, everyone. This is Mighty John, the record guy, with a Money Music Minute. You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin' by the Righteous Brothers is one of the most played songs in the history of radio and rock and roll. The 45 sold millions. Some copies are worth over $1,000. Which ones? The answer, right after this.
Once again, Mighty John Marshall.
Sometimes a record of a different color makes a big difference in value, such as the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. You've lost that. Regular black vinyl copies are worth up to $20. But if you have or find one on green vinyl, grab it. Green vinyl copies are valued up to $1,500. You can find the value of any record at moneymusic.com.
We'll get back to some of our thoughts about Memorial Day in a moment, but we should note the passing of Marcus Haynes, often called the greatest basketball dribbler in the history of basketball. The Globetrotter star has died at the age of 89 in Plano, Texas, of natural causes. And he made the Basketball Hall of Fame back in 98, actually the first Globetrotter to be so honored. Had two stints with the team from 47 to 53 and 72 to 79. That would be when he was 21 to 27 years of age, and then later when he was 46 to 53, and he toured with the Globetrotters. Unbelievable. Marcus Haynes played in more than 12,000 games, traveling more than 4 million miles, appearing in more than 100 countries, and he will be missed. In fact, the Globetrotters will dedicate their 90th anniversary tour next year to Marcus Haynes and wear a uniform patch in his tribute. Now, as we talk in this case with Paul, he's in Lincoln, Nebraska tonight. Hello, Paul. Welcome.
Yeah, how you doing tonight?
I'm fine, thank you.
This weekend, what I'm going to be doing is I'm an artist, and I stretch out big sheets, and I just let people put their handprints on them, and then we send them over to the troops.
Oh, that's very nice. What a great idea.
And what I'm encouraging America to do is, if there is someone who's in the service, they don't have to be overseas, but they're not home, and you're having a party or you're having an event or something, put out a sheet with some oil pastels or crayons or something to say, write something for them, trace your hand on it, write something for them, and then send it to them in your next care package so that they can see, hey, even that we care. Here, we're thinking of you while we're having our party.
What a really innovative idea. I think that's a great idea, Paul, and I commend you. You don't happen to have a website that how you started this or anything, do you?
Well, right now I'm on a mission across America, and what I'm doing is I'm going to two universities in each state.
All right.
And I'm trying to get people to take the ideas, the young people, the 90-0s. I call them the 90-0s, the kids from the 90s and the 0s. To take the idea and set it up for the family at the birthday parties, the anniversaries, the wedding receptions, and family reunions. Anywhere you get family together, get them to draw together. Get them to imagine together again so that they can bring the families back together. We need that in America really bad.
Boy, we surely do, Paul, and I thank you for that great idea and much appreciated. All right. Observe Memorial Day. That's all we're saying, folks. Please just observe Memorial Day. It does matter. Go to Jimbo near you at jimbotalk.net. You'll find out where we are near you in a variety of ways. And coming up in July the 25th, we're going to be in Quincy, Illinois. And I'll be addressing folks in public without even the benefit of a radio transmitter, although if we have time, we might be on the air there with affiliate WTAD at 9:30 on the dial. I think we'll probably be talking with them on the phone before I fly in, but I will be addressing two birthdays on Saturday, July the 25th, the 175th birthday of Quincy, not the TV character, no, but this the town, and the 90th anniversary of WTAD, and I'm looking forward to that. Thanks to Mike Moyers, their general manager, for making that happen. We'll be revisiting our good friends at WCLO in Janesville, Wisconsin, probably in the first week of November. Details sketchy, but that's a ways off, so we will do what we can there. Let you know when we get there. Don't forget that at WestwoodOneSports.com, coming up on Saturday, this coming day. That's where we're in Saturday here in the Eastern Time Zone. The national semifinals of the men's NCAA lacrosse tournament. 2:15 game is Notre Dame-Denver, and the 4:45 game, both Eastern Time, is Maryland and Johns Hopkins. And then on Monday, Memorial Day at 12:45, is the championship final. All right, women's NCAA World Series, the World Series of Softball, June the 1st. There's a 7:45 p.m. Eastern Time game, then the games at the same time on Tuesday and Wednesday, the 2nd and the 3rd of June. Called by Kevin Kugler and Leah Amico, the lacrosse tournament called by Dave Ryan, Mark Dixon, and Jason Horowitz. So, all good stuff right there. We'll take a quick break, come back with more on The Bohannon Show in just a moment.
An underwater land. Just hold your breath and hold my hand.
Jim Mayfield is president of Subsea Systems, which has something new, Clear Lounge, in which you go underwater wearing a helmet.
We just added oxygen, pumping oxygen into the helmet, but combining it in a freestanding aquarium.
And then you play.
We're delivering oxygen with a combination of aromatherapy, and the guests have choices, in a helmet. Underwater, playing games.
In a 13,000-square-foot aquarium.
The size of it is perfect for six guests, and then we have a host, bartender, safety diver, and then a safety diver photographer. So there's two staff underwater with the guests at all time.
Yeah. How deep underwater?
9 feet. So the guests are standing, but you're standing in 9 feet of water. And it's fresh water. We use salt for chlorination so you don't come out with that chlorine smell.
Yeah, that's never good, aromatherapy. And if you think this is cool...
It's heated, so it's at a really comfortable 85 degrees.
But that's the only liquid refreshment in Clear Lounge.
We actually have a bar in the sense that it is a bar guests lean on, and we have the underwater Jenga game that they're able to play at the bar. Social media, tablets, things like that are there on the bar.
And once you get out of the tank...
We also are making and selling oxygenated smoothies. So we're making real fruit juice smoothies and injecting into the blend oxygen that stays suspended in the drink, and guests are able to enjoy an ingested oxygen drink.
No antioxidants here. The first location for this is Cozumel, Mexico, with more to come, so go online and check it out.
There is a clear-lounge.com. That's our corporate website.
That's clear-lounge.com.
Wetsuit's not required. Just bathing suit and come and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, no skills needed at Clear Lounge.
It doesn't require any swimming or aquatic experience. If you can walk and breathe, you pretty much are ready to enjoy the experience.
Well, consider me qualified. There you go. Clear-lounge.com. I'm not sure what the big deal about oxygen is. Is that a high? Is it supposed to be a high? I've never known. But be that as it may. Some letters are going up for auction next month. Expect upwards of $20,000 for the letters of Albert Einstein. We'll just consider the value of E and MC squared alone, I would think, huh? Oh, if you missed this, in Socrates, New York, Diana Latton was busted on assault charges for pushing and spitting on people at her daughter's softball game on Mother's Day. Well, maybe we need to work on our behavior skills there just a little bit. Again, don't forget, Monday night, on Memorial Day night, we will observe the 50th anniversary of Ali Liston II, the fight that ended in one round. We will give you the complete Mutual Broadcasting play-by-play, or blow-by-blow, if you will. That's our predecessor network, of course. Again, in the third hour, midnight Eastern Time hour of the Jim Bohannon Show, Monday night. And we'll also do some discussion about boxing's place in sports today, what with mixed martial arts and all the rest of that. Again, JimboTalk.net. Please contribute to our poll, in which we ask you this week, when will Dzhokhar Tsarnaev be executed? Convicted, of course, of the Boston Marathon bombing and sentenced to death, but then the lawyers get to play their little games. So your choices, under a year, between 1 and 3 years, 3 to 5 years, more than 5 years, or he will never be executed. An interesting interesting thought. I would tend to go probably toward... more than 5 years, just because of the way the lawyers played our little games. We thanks very much our producer and webmaster, Mr. Paul Hill, JimboTalk.net. That's where we are. And our engineer for Friday evenings, of course, the redoubtable Walt Hassett. Again, Eric Blim will join us in our second hour Monday night to talk about his new book, Legend, and Special Forces in Vietnam. Until that time, yours truly sits in here doing his best, Jimbo Hannon, on Westwood One.